Welcome to the What's the Law podcast by the team at Jackson's Law Firm. Jackson's is a full-service law firm based in the northeast of England, working for businesses and private individuals. We're here to chat about what's the law and how it affects various stages in your life. In this episode, we will be explaining the forthcoming changes to the government's IR35 legislation and looking at how these will affect both contractors engaged via intermediaries and the businesses engaging them. Jackson's Head of Employment, Paul Clark, will be joined by Martin Johnson, partner at Torgerson's Accountants, for the discussion. Please note that we're recording this episode of What's the Law remotely, so please be aware that this may affect the quality of the audio.
Hi, I'm Martin Johnson, Chartered Accountant, with the firm of Chartered Accountants, Torgerson's. Based in the northeast, with three offices and 30 professional staff. I cover a whole range of client services, including helping contractors with IR35 and companies who employ contractors.
Hi, I'm Paul Clark. I'm a partner at Jackson's Law Firm and head of the employment team. We regularly advise clients on employment status issues, both individuals and the businesses.
Hi, I'm Matthew Rowanson. I'm an employment solicitor at Jackson's Law Firm, and I'm the host of the What's the Law podcast. Martin, can you just explain what exactly IR35 is?
It's essentially IR35. It's tax legislation designed to combat tax avoidance by workers supplying their services to clients via an intermediary, such as a limited company, but who would be an employee if the intermediary was not used. Those workers are called disguised employees by HMRC.
Is IR35 a new thing?
No, it's not, Matthew. It's been around for quite some while. It dates back in reality to the year 2000. Going back further still, Gordon Brown introduced attractive options for businesses to work through limited company format, but fairly soon the Treasury got the belief that there was abuse going on here. The response to that was in the Finance Act 2000 and then enshrined within the Income Tax Earnings and Pensions Act of 2003 were the rules that came in as part of IR35. There's a clue in the title IR35. It was actually the 35th press release behind the Finance Act 2000. So although there was perceived abuse, it wasn't exactly prioritised back then, 20 years ago.
Yes, and up until 2017, the responsibility for determining whether IR35 applied rested with the intermediaries, who were the personal service companies and such like, which the government wanted to look at from a disguised employment point of view. As of 2017, following changes made to the Income Tax Earning and Pensions Act, in particular Chapter 10, certainly in the public sector, we saw the responsibility for determining status move from the personal service company to the end user client in that sector. Although the private sector wasn't affected by these changes in 2017, up until the changes that are shortly going to come into place, responsibility remains with the personal service company rather than the end user client.
And why are we hearing about it now?
But there are two factors. Within that public sector, the response was created in 2017 in the public sector because of a massive increase in outsourcing that was going on. Local authorities and the NHS in general were asking for services to provide, perhaps on to use an NHS term, a locum type of basis. And the providers, whether they be in the background on the admin side or even frontline consultants, all found it more tax efficient to use a personal service company, a corporate entity to go into to go and perform the services. And similarly to that, we've seen a massive upsurge in the gig economy, as we call it. Again, a lot of operators or a lot of services provided by individuals on a contract basis. 2017 was a response to that, as Paul's alluded to, and the Treasury effectively perceived the rules as being successful, capturing opportunities to pull operators, contractors into a more higher taxed regime, let us say, and then want to roll it out into the private sector. That rollout is now imminent, having been postponed a couple of times, principally through COVID, to be fair, and also other developments which is probably more Paul's remit than mine, around the Taylor review and report about employment status and the rights of workers as well.
The government was really concerned about this disguised employment and individuals working through intermediaries avoiding tax. The rules obviously had always been there, but I think the perception from government was that there was widespread non-compliance with the legislation as it was. And that was the reason why they wanted to shake things up in the public sector initially to move that liability for determining whether IR35 applied up the work chain. So from the personal service company to the end user client. There was a perception that many personal service companies were either ignoring the duty or weren't fairly assessing determining the status of the worker. And let's remember, in many cases, the personal service company is the limited company or vehicle, which is operated by the worker themselves. So there wasn't probably any interest from their point of view in looking too deeply into this. It has been successful in the public sector. But I think that that's partly because in the public sector, a concern that to avoid any scrutiny from IR35, and therefore we saw a number of a blanket approach whereby businesses effectively decided that anyone who's engaged through a personal service company was caught by IR35. And that meant that a lot of contractors suddenly were told that they were now going to be treated as caught, and therefore tax and national insurance would be deducted from what was being paid to the personal service companies. Whereas in the private sector, certainly as a result of some of the tweaks to the legislation, I think there's going to be a lot more, certainly from the end user clients, that they're going to need to look at the relationships a lot more than applying a blanket approach and saying everyone's caught. And certainly workers and contractors will demand that, because it'll clearly have an effect on their earnings.
I was just going to add to Paul's point there. It's very true that the policing of the IR35 regulations was actually very, very expensive, because until the change in focus, which is really what the recent changes are about, HMRC had to go and investigate each individual contractor on an individual basis, and were finding it incredibly hard to set precedents that could then simplify their enforcement activities. And similarly, as Paul's already alluded to again, the contractor was the individual within the company, as they are personal service companies, assessing whether they were caught by IR35 rules or not. And that's akin to asking a turkey to vote for Christmas, really. So of course they all found the appropriate answers and rationales to rationalise that they were in their views not within IR35. And I think one of the fundamental issues we really want to remember here is that this ultimately comes back to a status question. Is the contractor operating under his own control and auspices? Is he, for want of a better way of putting it, in a more common way of putting it, is he really self-employed rather than under a contract which is an employed contract?
And you both talk about the changes in law that have been delayed. What actually are these changes, and when do they come into force?
Probably Paul better to answer the detail on that, but certainly the changes in law are coming into the private sector. We're going to be looking come April 2021. This having been delayed a year, we're still wondering whether COVID will cause a further delay in its implementation, but a lot of the media are making it at the moment very plain that it's not going to be delayed again. It is going to come in April 2021. And the change is fundamentally that the payer, the company employing the contractor, will have to make the assessment. And of course, that then makes the revenue's job far, far easier, because they only have to go and chase a smaller number of businesses who are taking on board employing these workers rather than the individual workers themselves. There are restrictions. Medium and large businesses are the ones caught by the change. Small businesses will not yet be caught. So if you are a small business, you have fewer than 50 employees or turnover of less than 10.2 million or what we call a balance sheet total, that's total assets, of less than 5.1 million, you can breach one of those limits. But so long as you satisfy two out of three, you will be small. And so small companies will still not be affected, but large and medium-sized businesses will. And there are plenty of sectors, construction, IT, finance, who will be affected, who are large employers of these contractor companies. So it's going to be quite impactful.
Yeah, so the end user client will have to carry out something called a status determination statement. And that's going to really be where they say whether IR35 applies to an individual engagement or it doesn't, and also why that they've reached that decision. That's going to need to be cascaded down the work chain. So they'll have to tell either the personal service company or if there's another intermediary in the between the end client and the personal service company, that organisation will have to tell them what their decision is. But they also have to tell the worker himself or herself what determination that they've reached. That worker, the contractor, will have the opportunity to challenge the determination. So there'll be a client-led status determination or status disagreement process. And that will also, as part of that process, but also in relation to making a determination, employers are going to have to take reasonable care. That's within the legislation, and that requires them really to turn their mind to this rather than applying a blanket approach as we saw happen in the public sector. And some of the HMRC guidance regarding what might amount to taking reasonable care will include using the CEST tool, which we'll come on to discuss in a moment, but that's the government's tool for assessing employment status. It's certainly not infallible, but those will at the very least be required to use that. But also they will need to take professional advice and also to include in the determination the workers' views. So there's quite a lot on the end user client here to do before they make that decision, and then also once they've made it to inform the relevant people. There's also going to be some provision for the transfer of liability. So if, for instance, there's an umbrella company or a payroll company which is inserted in that work chain, it disappears, it goes bust, for instance, and then liability will pass back up the chain towards the end client. It's supply chain compliance is the term which is being used. So it's really a question from the end user client to making sure that they're making the determination, but also that's passed through the chain and that everyone through the chain themselves knows what their responsibility is. And this requirement as well isn't just going to be to do it once when the new changes to the legislation comes in. End user clients are going to need to keep on top of their arrangements with individuals who they engage through personal service companies and other intermediaries in case anything changes. So if someone who's engaged through a personal service company starts doing working more hours or on a different basis, or if they work more predominantly for the end user clients and stop working for a range of other clients, well, that might actually affect the status determination. So it's going to be an ongoing process as well. It's something which is really here to stay.
Yes. Can I just add something to that, Paul? I think that's absolutely right. Contractors of mine have been looking at the CEST, the Contractor Employment Status tool. I will always argue that it's a good set of questions to take as a guide. There is an argument that says the tool points you in a slightly biased way. HMRC obviously deny that totally, and it is a computer program, so in reality it shouldn't have any bias. But of course, you can't get all the questions into a tool, and I would point contractors to that for their own purposes. But it is noticeable, as you've said, Paul, that there is a lot of work going to go on to the paying organisations, the ones at the companies at the top of the chain, as you put it. And anecdotal evidence about early preparation to what was thought to be the April 2020 introduction indicated that a lot of payers were almost taking a blanket approach and were surprisingly perhaps willing to put their contractors on their payroll, almost rather than go through all of the admin, actually just say, oh, to pot with the admin, you're now an employee. There was a huge backlash from the contractors, especially in their media, to that.
No, but I'm wise to this as something which might happen. And there may be contractors who work predominantly or exclusively for one end user client who might not have too much opposition to becoming an employee of that client rather than being engaged through their personal service company if the client determines that IR35 applies. Because let's remember that IR35 determines whether someone's employed or self-employed for tax purposes. It's all about tax. It doesn't grant them employment rights. I think if I was in the position of being a contractor working exclusively for one business through my personal service company, and they said to me, IR35 applies, and now you'll be paid an amount from which we have deducted tax and national insurance contributions, would probably say, well, if you're going to pay me as an employee, then I'd like to be an employee, and I'd like the employment rights that go with that. However, I think the situation probably different for contractors who work for a range of businesses and a range of organisations where one or two of those organisations say IR35 applies and then take the approach which you've just described, Martin, and say to pot with it, we'll make you an employee, because they might then also require that individual, if they're an employee, to not work with other organisations, or that might have an effect on the contractor's business because they might not then be able to work for the organisations which are in competition with the business who has said to them that they're now going to be treated as an employee. So, yeah, I think there will certainly be contractors who won't be happy with just being told it being indicated that we want you to become an employee. And that could potentially lead to contractors deciding that they're going to work for fewer end-user clients, or end-user clients who are more prepared to acknowledge the fact that they're in business on their own account. Because IR35, and it's one of the reasons why the blanket approach was taken in the public sector, is because it's only if you say that IR35 doesn't apply as an end user client that you face any liability. If you say it applies, then that's okay. If you say it doesn't apply, then that's when potentially further down the line, HMRC might come back and say to you, well, why doesn't it apply? We think it does, therefore there's tax and national insurance owed.
Yeah, and you mentioned the CESS tool, which can offer some help, but what other help is there available for people who may be affected by IR35?
Well, we're jumping in on that one, Matthew, because just to finish off the issue around CESS, Paul and I are effectively therefore in agreement that it's useful from our point of view that if our clients, whether they be the paying employer or the working contractor, it's useful to go and have a look at that and try and answer the questions. As I say, I've got a strong suspicion there's a bit of inbuilt bias there, so I wouldn't necessarily rely on the outcome of it. Therefore, as a result, there's really no substitute for notwithstanding having done that and maybe got a feel for it, that you go and speak to a professional who's quite well versed and experienced in this arena, in the self-employed personal service company arena, an accountant or a lawyer. And take some advice around the interpretation of it. You know, we're all here to help, and that I think is critical, to be perfectly honest.
Well, there was already some guidance from HMRC out there on IR35 and whether it applies or not, and that does point towards some of the factors which will be taken into account in determining employment status. Although if you were to read through all the cases, you probably will go well beyond April when IR35 comes in. Certainly, CESS tool is a really good starting point, and that really can, if that outcome is something which generally, if you're the contractor, which confirms what you think, and also the approach which the end user client believes, then that's usually a good sign. I think the difficulty is going to be where an end user client takes a conservative approach and just is very content to say that IR35 applies. The CESS tool also says that, but you're the contractor and you disagree. That's probably where you need to start thinking about some evidence that you can build so that you can show that the determination that IR35 may not be correct. So if there's occasions when you have provided a substitute, when someone's come in and done the work when you've not been able to do it, then obviously having a record of those occasions and using those as examples can be used to rebut the argument that IR35 applies on the basis that personal service is one of the requirements. Because clearly if you're able to provide a substitute, and you have done in the past, then it's not, you know, the personal service isn't required of you. You can have someone else come in and do that. I think, yeah, as Martin said, it's quite a complex area, really. It does certainly pay to take advice at an early stage. If you're an end user client, you might want to take that advice generally so you know how to make these determinations for a number of people. And if you're a contractor, really it's looking at it from the point of view of how you can rebut what is probably going to be the indication that you're unhappy with. And certainly Martin and myself are quite used to IR35 now. We've been discussing this and doing webinars and seminars for a number of years. So yeah, we're certainly happy to help.
I think that's right, Paul. One other thing to bear in mind is that while CEST isn't the worst, there's a lot of jargon around this. And, you know, I think you need to find somebody who can rephrase some of the technicality jargon items into workaday English. And you know, with our experience, I like to think we can do that.
So if I'm either an individual or a business who's going to be affected by our IR35 or is already, what should I be doing between now and April?
I think certainly perhaps the first thing is to assess whether you are going to need to look at this. Companies who are taking on board worker contractors certainly need to assess their scale. They need to look at their turnover balance sheets and employee numbers to assess whether they're going to have to be aware of it and make the status determination statements that Paul's alluded to. And then there's a lot of work to be done to look at, as Paul says, not just the wording of the existing contract, not just the contract, but also ensuring the actuality of the work done and the way it's delivered is in line with the contract. From the contractor's point of view, they need to be assessing from their side, reassessing the issues relating to IR35 and to how many boxes they tick for being truly self-employed in terms of the tax and NICE side of things, and probably do need a little bit of coaching and training and explanation of the whole status determination statement, what it means, because they will need to have that knowledge if the status determination statement comes down the track to them and is not what they want. It's not what they perceive their role to be. So some of this has been ongoing already within our client base in probably about this time last year. And then when we understood there was going to be a further delay, it went on pause, of course. And now we've had COVID. So even working has been on pause, let alone the nature of how we work. There's probably quite a lot to do in the next four and a bit months before it's introduced.
Yes, I would echo that, Martin. I think that the first question, yeah, from the end client and business point of view, is to look whether the small company exception applies or not. But then if it doesn't, you're going to be faced with that question of carrying out the determination. I think it's important to review the relationships you have with your contractors engaged through personal service companies. Do the written terms reflect the reality of the relationship? If they don't, how do you get hold of the information which fills in the gaps? Having conversations with the contractors at an early stage to explain to them, because some contractors might not be fully aware of what IR35 is going to mean for them. So as an end user client, you might have to explain that to them and explain what you will have to do and then how you're going to tell them. And you can't really start that early enough, because the requirement's going to be from the 6th of April 2021 that you'll have needed to have carried out these status determination statements by that stage. But it doesn't mean you can't start looking at those now and obviously keep them under review up until that date. If you're a contractor and you know that this decision is going to be made. It's probably helpful at this stage to start looking at evidence that you can put together, which confirms your belief, if that is that IR35 doesn't apply, because it's not disguised employment. You're in work on your own account. The business maybe does work for lots of different end user clients, so that that shows that you're not just exclusively working for that end user client, but also that the terms reflect that, and if they don't, to ask for the agreement to be updated so that it reflects as close as it can the reality of the relationship, so that there's something there ahead of the change in the application of IR35 coming in.
And finally, can I just ask you both to give a key piece of advice that you would give to those affected by IR35? Can I start with you, Martin?
Certainly, yes. If you know you're a contractor, you will know if you're a contractor. You will be preparing accounts. Do take heed of it. You know, even if you're not working at the moment because work is a bit more scarce than it was, take the time to go and look at the resources that are out there. Yes, the government website. Yes, the contractor employment status tool. But you'll need to speak to a professional advisor. You'll need to cut through the jargon. You'll need to lay out your own personal circumstances, because there are so many different nuances. The individual circumstances can vary so greatly. You must speak to a professional advisor, accountants or lawyers. Paul and myself are here, and we're working flat out and perfectly happy to take on board more people just to help guide through the future months and then into the new regime and beyond.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think what you can do as a business initially is to make a list of all your engagements with contractors through personal service companies. Try and maybe put them into groups in terms of the contracts that you're using for each of them. You might have a standard contract, or you might have lots of different template contracts. And then look at those relationships with the individuals and whether they are affected by the contract terms or whether actually the contract's now completely out of date, because the reality of the relationship is something entirely different. And then go and speak to the contractors and make sure that you're on the same page about what you need to do in the run-up to April and why you're having to do this, and take their view about some of the points which you're going to have to consider when you're making your determinations. So use the CESS tool, have a look at the questions which are in there, complete that from your point of view, ask the contractors to complete from their point of view, and then where there's any divergence. From a contractor's point of view, I think, as I said earlier, it's really about making sure that you've got evidence that you're in work on your own account, that personal service company is maybe working for more than one end user client, that your accounts obviously reflect that. And also, if there have been occasions where someone else has assisted you with doing work or maybe done the work on your behalf, so that if you have used a substitute, that's recorded and can be used to challenge any determination which you disagree with. The sooner you start addressing this, the easier it will be. Whilst there are sources of guidance out there, it certainly will pay in the long run to take some professional advice, particularly in relation to the question of employment status, because there's a lot of case law and there's a lot of issues which feed into that. And speaking to someone who has dealt with these issues before on behalf of clients and understands the sort of difficulties which businesses and contractors face is going to be invaluable. And it also goes from the end user client point of view to showing that you've taken reasonable care if HMRC are, you know, in the future, if they look at the arrangements and question how you reached the determination you did.
I'd like to thank our guests on this episode, and also thank you for listening to What's the Law podcast by the team from Jackson's Law Firm. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on your favourite podcasting app. Share this podcast, find us on social media, and use the hashtag What's the Law Pod. You can also visit our website, www.jackson-law.com. We look forward to you joining us for another episode of What's the Law in the future.